acceptance of government policy concerning UFO reports continued. Project Grudge listed and evaluated 244 UFO sightings. Then in 1949, a memo that came out of the CIA's Office of Scientific Investigation was very apprehensive about unexplained sightings of flying objects. Then, in 1952, another CIA memo came to light from the head of the Office of Scientific Investigation's Weapons and Equipment Division. It also complained about our lack of knowledge and police in the area of UFO sightings. Now, even the CIA, it seemed, was at odds with itself at its various levels of bureaucracy over what to do about UFOs. Generals Twining and Vandenberg had had enough. In 1952, the Air Force formally initiated Project Blue Book. At least, if we weren't going to do anything about UFOs publicly, we had to have a way to salve the public's fear about UFO sightings. Blue Book was that salve. Whatever the working group was supposed to be doing in 1952, it wasn't satisfying the National Security Council, which ordered the CIA to determine whether the existence of UFOs would create a danger to the United States. Of course, the CIA already knew, because two of its intelligence directors had been members of the working group, that UFOs were displaying hostile intentions, not only to the United States, but to the Soviets, the Italians, and the Scandinavians as well. All of NATO was trying to figure out a response to the UFO threat without triggering a reaction from the Soviets. That was one of the reasons, 30 years later, President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev could come to a meeting of the minds about UFOs that ultimately brought an end to the need for a Cold War. On January 14, 1953, just before the inauguration of President Eisenhower, CIA officials and Air Force officers met at the Pentagon at the CIA's invitation to discuss the UFO situation and what our working group had learned up to that point. Officiated at first by Dr. H.P. Robertson, a CIA employee, and the director of the Weapons System Evaluations Group in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the group also had a working group member, Dr. Lloyd Berkner, a physicist and one of the directors of the Brookhaven National Laboratories, as one of its members. The Robertson panel spent the next 3 days reviewing case histories of UFO sightings assembled for them by the Air Force Intelligence and saw two films that contained footage of alleged flying saucers. The panel concluded there was no threat to the United States and recommended that the government should start debunking UFO sightings in general. This, the CIA reported as late as 1988, was the only official government response to UFO sightings. Just over a year later, the White House agreed that it was necessary to have some sort of policy governing the release of UFO information to the press. In order to keep lower-level officers from releasing unauthorized information, and by unauthorized, the National Security Council advising the president meant only that the information cleared by the working group, General Nathan Twining, now the Air Force Chief of Staff, signed off on Air Force Regulation 200-2, which said that it was permissible to release reports to the media only when the object was identifiable, like swamp gas or a meteorite. But only the Air Technical Intelligence Center could determine which objects were identifiable and which weren't. In other words, only the ATIC could authorize the release of any information about UFOs, and they did so only when the objects were clearly identifiable as common phenomena and not flying saucers. Throughout the 1950s, I witnessed the government become more and more secretive about UFOs, even though privately I thought they would get better information if they were more open about it. But I was also a military officer and understood the necessity of keeping information confidential until you understood what it was. Besides, the Soviets were making great strides in the race to get into space, and we didn't know if they were getting cooperation from the EBEs. There was truly a war on, and I had followed orders on the White House staff even as I watched the officers in the cover-up begin to trip over their own feet time and again. the darkness was closing in all around us. In 1961, the Air Force began two secret projects that, in effect, had been in operation since 1947, but had not been committed to policy. Moondust had to do with the establishment of recovery teams to retrieve and recover crashed or grounded foreign space vehicles. But for all intents and purposes, as far as the public was concerned, the Air Force was looking for Soviet satellites that had fallen out of the sky and landed on Earth. But in reality, the Air Force was establishing a recovery of UFOs program, just like the Army had pulled a crashed UFO out of the New Mexico desert 14 years earlier. Then, in Project Bluefly, the Air Force authorized the immediate delivery of foreign crashed space vehicles and any other item of technical intelligence interest to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, for evaluation. It was a repeat of General Twining's retrieval of the space vehicle from the 509th to Wright Field in 1947. In 1962, one of the assistants to the Secretary of Defense, Arthur Sylvester, told the press at a briefing that if the government deemed it necessary for reasons of national security, it would not even furnish information about UFOs to Congress, let alone the American public. Now, I was at the Pentagon, and I fully understood how the Air Force was moving to take control of the entire UFO situation. NASA had the mandate from the president to manage space exploration, but the military still had to defend against the UFO threat, even though we were being hampered at every turn. Air Force Project Saint and Blue Gemini years later were outgrowths of USAF 7795, a code number for the USAF's first anti-satellite program, an aggressive operation designed to locate, track, and destroy enemy surveillance satellites or, and more importantly, orbiting UFOs. Using the technology we had developed at R&D, the Air Force and then the Army was taking the initial steps to defend the U.S. missile system against Soviet attacks from space and defend the planet against UFO intrusions. SAINT was an orbital UFO inspector satellite, a version of the standard Agenda B satellite that the CIA had been using that had an onboard TV camera and tracking and targeting radar system. Its job was surveillance. Find a potential enemy satellite or UFO lurking in orbit and lock onto it with a TV camera and with radar. Once the lock was in place, Blue Gemini, the killer satellite, would move in. One of the projects developed by Hughes Aircraft, a prime air defense contractor and satellite builder, Blue Gemini was the military version of NASA's manned Gemini capsule. Its mission, purely and simply, was to swoop in from a higher orbit and kill or disable an enemy satellite or a UFO. If possible, the Blue Gemini would try to capture a UFO in orbit by rendering it immobile and waiting for a manned military astronaut mission to spacewalk over and retrieve whatever we could. Both of these weapons, under the cover of other missions, of course, were eventually deployed, and today they form one of the lines of defense in an anti-missile and anti-UFO surveillance system. SAINT and Blue Gemini were important first steps in our war against the UFOs. The technology that came out of Army R&D in the 1960s, retrieved from the aliens themselves, led directly to our ability to put up such a defense against the aliens, even though in the hours after the crash at Roswell, our situation looked completely hopeless. Like many of the products that came out of R&D and were used for military purposes, they had consumer uses. And today, if you look at the small dish digital direct broadcast television satellite antennas that are being marketed all across the country, you'll see Hughes' own brand. It's an example of how technology originally earmarked for the military winds up as the most basic and everyday consumer product. On December 17, 1969, the Secretary of the Air Force announced the termination of Project Blue Book. He said that Blue Book's review of more than 13,000 cases and yielded no information that there was a threat to national security in any way, and that, in effect, since every sighting processed by Blue Book had been identified as something earthly and not extraterrestrial, there were, by definition, no such things as unidentified flying objects. Blue Book had done its job and now could report that our skies were safe. But Blue Book had been pure public relations from the start, and the military evaluation of UFOs continued uninterrupted. In 1975 and early 1976, Air Force nuclear weapons repositories at Loring Air Force Base in Maine and the all-important Sensitive Strategic Air Command facility at Minot, North Dakota, and other facilities in Montana, Michigan, and even the Royal Canadian Air Force Base at Falconbridge in Ontario had been seriously encroached upon by UFOs. These weren't just random sightings. UFOs actually conducted surveillance and scanning operations at the bases that resulted in security alerts and classified reports to Washington about the intrusions. Then NASA finally got a project up and running to scan for radio transmissions from any advanced civilizations whose signals we could pick up, called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and endorsed by the late Carl Sagan, SETI was not only a set of receivers around the world, but a set of international protocols governing what would happen if contact was made with an extraterrestrial civilization. For over 50 years now, the war against UFOs has continued as we try to defend ourselves against their intrusions. The Hughes hunter-killer satellites of the 1970s were our first steps in deploying a planetary defense system that held any real threat against EBEs. When, late in the 1970s, we realized that a directed energy weapon and a high-energy laser were even more effective than exploding satellites, our defensive ability was enhanced even further. We recognized that by applying both the technology we found at Roswell and Tesla's version of a particle beam to our own anti-satellite missiles and laser targeting equipment, we could achieve the rapid aim, rapid fire capability that these type of defenses demanded. But we were still playing cover-up games, even though the Russians were now finally acknowledging that maybe cooperation between the superpowers was called for to meet a common threat. In the 1980s, both President Reagan and Chairman Gorbachev recognized the need for cooperation against a common enemy. While neither officially owned up to the threat of EBEs and alien hostilities, both acknowledged that if the United States and the Soviet Union could lay aside their differences and participate in a shared policy to defend the space around the Earth, then both superpowers would benefit. For his part, President Reagan pushed hard for the rapid development and deployment of a space defense technology to defend the planet, called the Strategic Defense Initiative and derisively dubbed Star Wars by the press. The SDI was described in 1985 in President Reagan's own words as a defensive shield that won't hurt people but will knock down nuclear weapons before they can hurt people. Briefly, the Strategic Defense Initiative was described by the White House and the military as a space-based defense system to protect the United States from an all-out nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. It would include satellites that could detect a massive nuclear launch within seconds, orbiting lasers to destroy the first wave of missiles, laser-equipped submarines that could defend against the next round of attacks, and a ground-based missile system providing the last line of defense. In addition, the SDI also included what I thought was the best of its weapons, a missile-launched kinetic energy beam weapon that locked onto incoming warheads or low-orbiting space vehicles and knocked out their electronics with a particle beam. The elegant aspect of the kinetic energy beam weapon was that you couldn't really defend against it. Lasers, even high-energy lasers, had their shortcomings in that once a laser beam bounced off a surface, the surrounding energy envelope protected the surface from subsequent pulses. You either knocked out your target right away or shielded it against subsequent hits. But with a particle beam weapon, you penetrated the surface, just like microwaving a piece of meat, destroyed its electronics to render it useless, and then broke it apart or melted it from within. Amidst the warnings that the SDI wouldn't work was a giant unscientific gamble and a corporate giveaway, couldn't provide the massive shield against nuclear missiles, would violate the ABM treaty President Johnson had negotiated with the Russians, and was a giant waste of taxpayers' money, guess what? It worked. We didn't have to shoot down thousands of Soviet incoming warheads, and the Soviets never really cared about the ABM treaty in the first place because they knew they weren't going to launch a first strike, and neither would we. We both knew who the real targets of SDI were, and it wasn't a bunch of ICBM warheads. It was the UFOs, alien spacecraft, thinking themselves invulnerable and invisible as they soared around the edges of our atmosphere, swooping down at will to destroy our communications with EMP bursts, buzz our spacecraft, colonize our lunar surface, mutilate cattle in their own horrendous biological experiments, and even abduct human beings for their medical tests and the hybridization of the species. And what was worse, we had to let them do it because we had no weapon to defend ourselves. These creatures weren't benevolent beings who had come to enlighten human beings. They were genetically altered humanoid automatons. Cloned biological entities, actually, who were harvesting biological specimens on Earth for their own experimentation. As long as we were incapable of defending ourselves, we had to allow them to intrude as they wished, and that was part of what the working group had to deal with. We had negotiated a kind of surrender with them as long as we couldn't fight them. They dictated the terms because they knew what we most feared was disclosure. Hide the truth, and the truth becomes your enemy. Disclose the truth, and it becomes your weapon. We hid the truth, and the EVEs used it against us until 1974, when we had our first real shootdown of an alien craft over Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. They had tried to disrupt our space program for years. Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and even the space shuttle. They buzzed our capsules traveling through space, interfered with our transmissions, and pulsed us with EMP bursts, just like we used to do with the Soviet surface ships when we would hit them with a radar burst so massive it would send their earphone-wearing radar and sonar techs howling in pain down to the ship's dispensary. But when the EVEs did it to us, we had no response. That was before SDI. Once launched and tested, our space-based high-energy lasers, or HELs, acted like the lightning bolts on the nights of July 3rd and July 4th, 1947, that so thoroughly disrupted the electromagnetic wave propagators in the spacecraft flying over Roswell that the pilots couldn't retain control of their own vehicle. We eventually realized that what happened then was that a natural version of an advanced particle beam burst actually brought a UFO down even as it tried to escape. When we deployed our advanced particle beam weapon and tested it in orbit for all to see, the EVEs knew, and we knew they knew, that we had our defense of the planet in place. Gorbachev, believe it or not, was also pleased because President Reagan guaranteed that the United States would throw its defensive shield around the Soviet Union, too. Sure, the two leaders shook hands and embraced one another in public. What they had achieved together, cooperating when they were supposed to be fighting, was nothing short of miraculous. Whatever we were fighting over became minimally important in the face of a threat from creatures who were so superior to us in technology that we were their farm animals to be harvested as they pleased. But when the United States and the USSR agreed in the early 1980s not to fight each other over this territory or that territory, to cooperate so as to defeat the common foe, we were unbeatable. Now, as the space shuttle docks with the Mir, and the astronauts and the cosmonauts share a toast of vodka from their plastic squeeze tubes and look out into the darkest reaches of space, they know that there is an electronic shield around them. Now that the war is just about over and we defend our beachhead, the truth will ultimately be revealed. The real truth behind a 50-year history of a war that looked like the ultimate defeat for humankind amidst a Cold War that threatened us with nuclear annihilation can now finally be told because we prevailed. It was because in the dark hours just before dawn in July of 1947, the Army, only dimly recognizing that we were on the edge of a potential cataclysmic event, pulled the crashed space vehicle out of the desert and harvested its parts, just like the inhabitants of that vehicle wanted to harvest us. In these moments, even though we might have fallen over ourselves in the darkness of the next 50 years, we set in motion the processes that brought us to an initial resolution with a military power greater than us. It helped us in our confrontation with the Russians, and if we don't lose our way, will help us manage the threats to come. When that truth of alien intervention in our planet's affairs and our ongoing contact with an alien culture is finally revealed, it won't be frightening, even though it will be a shock. The night closes in around you in the desert, exposing your deepest terrors of childhood boogeymen to the desolation of the landscape and the blackness of the sky. So even inside your car, you keep on chattering to keep the night away. And that's what I think about all of it, UFOs, the Cold War, and all of it, I told my companion in the car sitting next to me as we drove south through the New Mexico desert toward the town of Roswell. I may be over 80 now, but that's what I think. The night was swallowing us up as our car twisted around the curves on the crowned road surface, still warm and wet on a summer night from passing thunderstorms heading toward lights we knew were over the horizon, but still could not see. The Cold War, the missile crisis of 1962, the worldwide alert in 1973, all history now, don't you think? I asked. Maybe it was a good thing that the aliens forced us to defend the planet. At least it kept us in the Cold War, even though we were using real bullets. And what makes you think the Cold War is over, Tavadich? My friend asked as he carefully took out a cigarette and lit it and blew the smoke out the window. American cigarettes, he said. Am I not the most bourgeois, decadent person you've ever met? But what would the Amerikanskis have done without me? And I laughed to myself and counted the million stars across the desert sky as far as I could see, cattle sleeping near the scrub and sand fences along the side of the lonely state route, a coyote now and then running through the beams of our headlights, and the sound of my friend's breath as he blew the column of smoke into the desert air. It was a night just like this, lightning crackling off in the distance and a thunderclap rolling across the desert floor. A night just like this. And what looked like a bright shooting star blazed very bright in an arc from south to north and disappeared over a rise as we continued toward Roswell into the darkness of the New Mexico night. Afterward. Back in the 1950s, I remember watching a television series called I Led Three Lives about the exploits of Herbert A. Philbrick, who described the fantastic but true story of his life as a member of a Communist Party cell and an undercover operative for the FBI. Years later, when I got into Army R&D, I remember thinking about how my own story was also fantastic but true, and how what General Trudeau and I did helped to change the course of history. Very few people know that what was coming out of foreign technology during the early 1960s had some basis in a crash of a UFO that officially never took place. Lives were distorted, careers destroyed, children frightened into submission by Army counterintelligence boogeymen. Businessmen in Roswell threatened with financial ruination and even worse if anybody told the story of what happened. But they were all loyal Americans, and even though some might have had their doubts about hiding the truth, they went along with what the Army wanted. Many people have criticized the Army and the government for maintaining the Roswell cover-up not only at the time but also through the years. For that, I need to say a word in defense of what the Army did. It's easy to criticize if you weren't an adult back then or someone who didn't understand the politics that governed our thinking at that point in American history. We had not yet fully made the transition from a nation at war to a nation at peace. And there was Harry Truman, still reeling from his sudden ascendancy to the presidency, toughened into steel by his decision to drop the atomic bombs on Japan, and now faced with the monumental impact of a crash landing of a strange craft on American soil. Was it Soviet? Did it belong to a foreign power? Was it hostile? We simply didn't know and weren't about to say anything until we knew what it was. Was it a flying saucer? The last time a public announcement of a landing by extraterrestrials took place, even though it was entertainment, panic ensued. In the aftermath of the war and the fear surrounding the Cold War, we didn't want to risk another panic. So the military recommended and the White House agreed to clam up. Just like the secrecy surrounding the Manhattan Project, no word gets out. And for the next 50 years, that policy, once put into place, governed the behavior of the U.S. government and the military about the existence of UFOs and the crash at Roswell. You can also ask how the government was able to keep the secret for so long. Had there been any other cover-up so efficient and thorough that it went on unbeknownst to succeeding presidents year after year until it was finally stopped? In fact, there was just such a cover-up, started in the war, but continued as a matter of policy by Truman in 1947, codenamed Shamrock. Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, one of the original members of the UFO working group, convinced his boss, President Truman, in 1947 to continue working with International Telephone and Telegraph, Western Union, and RCA to make their international communications traffic available for inspection by U.S. military intelligence services. Even though its initial purpose was to monitor any communications of military significance, such as the transmission of military secrets, there were no controls on what was inspected and what was not. This program continued for the next 28 years and kept secret from every president until it was terminated under the Ford administration in 1975. Does Shamrock mean that UFOs exist? Of course not. But it does reveal the capability of the U.S. government to keep an ongoing operation secret from even the President of the United States, much like the UFO working group under James Forrestal. So what do I think about all of this, about what happened and what I did? I believe that because at the time I was so much in the routine of a military intelligence officer, I didn't really stop to think about the implications of UFOs and EBEs. I understood that we were fighting a Cold War with the Soviets and a skirmish war with extraterrestrials. I believe that their intentions were and still are hostile, and I believe that we took the steps necessary to develop the weapons that can blunt their threat. In fact, the U.S. military has better, more accurate, and more powerful weapons for killing UFOs than were deployed in the movie Independence Day. We can knock these guys down tomorrow with high-energy lasers and directed particle beam weapons that come right out of a Star Wars movie. And these aren't fiction, they're fact. If you want to know more, pay a visit to the U.S. Army Space Command website on the Internet. These missile-launched HELs are the pride of our planetary defense system and a direct result of President Reagan's courage in pushing for the Strategic Defense Initiative when everyone said it wouldn't work. and that SDI was a direct result of the work General Trudeau and I did at Army R&D in 1962. Sometimes things just work the way they're supposed to. Sometimes, once in a very long while, you get the chance to save your country, your planet, and even your species at the same time. And when that time comes, as Davy Crockett once said, be sure you're right, then go ahead.
The Day After Roswell was written by Colonel Philip Corso, retired, with William J. Burns, and read by William J. Burns. It was recorded by Brandon Beatty at Common Mode Studios in East Hanover, New Jersey. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. The Day After Roswell was produced and directed by Paul Fowley. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Day After Roswell is available in print from Pocket Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.